How many of you have ever done a family history study? Gone on to genealogy.com or what are some of those other websites that are there? How far back were you able to take your family, Patricia? Really? And so where do you come from? England. Mm-hmm. Did you find out where in England? Anybody else ever do that? Do a genealogical study? Done. How far back? Mm-hmm. And we're in Germany. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Cynthia. All right. My brother-in-law tried to do some research into my wife's family history, but the Irish genealogical lists are so convoluted, it's hard to trace back too far. But I did a little research into the Kelly family, and about all I found out is that, yes, Kelly comes from Ireland, and probably about four generations ago, somebody from Ireland immigrated over here, and that's the roots of the Kelly family. Although there is a difference between the Kellys with a Y and the Kellys with an EY, they come from separate parts of Ireland. If I'm remembering this right, the EYs come from somewhere along the coast and the Ys come from up in the hills. So that's about all I know about my family history. But even some of you that have done much research on it, you were able to trace back about 400 years or so. That's impressive to know how that far back where you've come from. We're going to take a look at a list of names today in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, as we continue our study of this gospel that traces back the ancestry of a person a little over 2,000 years. Now, can you imagine being able to trace your family history back 2,000 years? And even in another gospel, Luke gives us the family history all the way back to the beginning, to the very first man. Now, I have heard I have heard rumors that there are some people over in the Arabic countries that claim to be able to trace their lineage all the way back, because that was an important part of that culture, to know where you came from, to know what your ancestry was. We've sort of lost that sense of connectedness to the past here in America. And so we don't keep track of those things very well. But for the Jewish people, in the first century, this was especially important. And there's a lot of reasons for it. But as we get into this list of names this morning, this is not something that we can just gloss over and say, it doesn't mean all that much to us. And occasionally, I think we are tempted to do that when we run into the genealogies. Because, okay, everybody cover your eyes for just a second. And, all right, when you're doing your devotions, how many of you skim 1 Chronicles 1 to 11? Okay, I know, you don't read it and you don't actually pronounce all those names, you just skim it. You can go ahead and admit that, nobody's looking. Right? Well, we do, because we tend to gloss over these sorts of things and think, it's just a bunch of names, what purpose does that have? Well, these names are full of purpose. They are full of importance, especially as it comes to what Matthew is trying to communicate to his people. As we said last week, Matthew has a very particular point to make, like all the gospel writers do. He is writing to Jewish believers and to the Jewish community at large, trying to convince them that Jesus is the promised Messiah. He's the one that fulfills the promises that God gave to the nation. Because Jesus came, he presented himself to the Jewish people and they rejected him. That culminated with the crucifixion, that rejection. And afterwards, there was another opportunity for Israel to receive her Messiah, and that is Matthew's presentation. He's presenting Christ as the fulfillment of the promises given all throughout the Old Testament. Matthew quotes the Old Testament more than any of the other gospel writers. Why is that? Because his audience was extremely familiar with the Old Testament. Matthew refers back to the prophecies of the Old Testament more than any other gospel writers. Why is that? Because he's trying to show that Jesus is the fulfillment of those prophecies. And he begins that in the first line of his book, this, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Right from the start, he's going to point back to two important figures in the ancestry of the Lord Jesus, because to Abraham and to David were given key promises that shaped the fate of the nation. God's purposes for Israel are summed up in these two covenants, the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant. And so this list of names starts off with these two to let us know that Jesus is the fulfiller of promises. Why is it that we need to point so heavily and so succinctly to the Lord Jesus? Because he's the one that fulfills these promises. He is the son of Abraham. He is the son of David. Well, what promises were given to David? To David were given the promises of an eternal dynasty. Talk about a dynasty being an entire succession of family members on a throne. Do you realize the average length of a dynasty is not more than a few generations? Because as typically happens in a kingdom, somebody rises up and overthrows the previous dynasty. Egypt went through 20-some dynasties throughout their 3,000 years of history. Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, had several dynasties as they went through. You look at the kings of England, and I haven't checked this, so I can't say with certainty how many dynasties were there, but Israel, the southern tribe, the southern kingdom of Israel, the tribe of Judah, had a singular dynasty throughout its entire existence, from the time of David onward, because the promise that God gave to David. When David wanted to build the temple and God came to him and said, you're not going to build the temple, but I'm going to give you this promise. The first part of that was an eternal dynasty. David, it will always be your family that rules over Israel. It will always, you'll never lack a man to sit on the throne of Israel. That promise has continued on throughout history. Why is it important that Jesus can trace his lineage back to David? Because he has to be a member of the Davidic line in order to inherit the throne. And so Matthew's going to trace Jesus' genealogy back to David. David was also given the promise of the kingdom of Israel, that his family would rule over the kingdom, and that kingdom involved both a Davidic king and Israel dwelling securely in the land. Well, when has Israel ever dwelt securely in the land? When was there ever a time when Israel dwelt in that land when they weren't being threatened by enemies? Well, there was only one time in the past, and that was under David, when he conquered all the enemies. There was peace. That's why Solomon was able to spend his entire career as king building up the temple and building all the palaces and enlarging the borders and becoming a prosperous nation, because his father David secured peace by defeating all of his enemies. That type is going to present itself in the Lord Jesus, who will do that same thing, but in a bigger way. Often when you look at types in the Old Testament, you say, well, what do they mean? Well, you have the type in the Old Testament, like David, and you say the antitype in the New Testament, the fulfillment, is going to do something similar, but in a bigger way. You read Daniel, and you read about Antiochus Epiphanes and the abomination of desolation that he committed when he offered a pig on the altar and set up a statue of Zeus in the temple at Jerusalem. You say that was a fulfillment of what the angel told to Daniel, but there's another one coming that's going to be bigger. When the Antichrist walks into the temple and instead of sacrificing a pig and setting up an altar of Zeus, sets up a statue of himself, declares himself to be God, and tries to take the kingdom of the entire world to himself. So what Antiochus Epiphanes did typifies what the Antichrist is going to do. And the similar thing with David. What David did as a king, Jesus is going to do in a bigger way. David was able to secure peace for Israel through his campaigns. Jesus is going to secure peace for Israel in a permanent way and in a universal way. David expanded the borders of Israel to include most of the Middle East, and all the nations around Israel were at peace with him. As we read in Psalm 2 this morning, when God establishes his son as the king over Israel, Jesus is going to extend the nation, the influence of the nation, the rulership of the nation of Israel over the entire world, not just a small portion of it. What David did in part, Jesus is going to do completely. So that promise of a Davidic son ruling over the nation of Israel as they dwell in peace in the land is important, because it means that Jesus is going to be the one that fulfills those promises given to David. To David was also given the promise of a son that would be obedient. It's implied in the Davidic covenant when God says, "And I will, your son will be my son. If he disobeys me, I'll discipline him with the rod of men. But if he obeys me, I'll establish his kingdom forever." Well, which son of David completely obeyed the father so that the kingdom of Israel could be established forever? Only Jesus. Did Solomon completely obey the father? No. Did Rehoboam completely obey the father? No. Did any of them, down through the line, Jehoshaphat, Joram, Ahaz, Uzziah, even the righteous king Josiah, did any of them completely obey the father so that the kingdom could be established forever? The answer obviously is no, because in 586, the southern kingdom came to an end, and Israel has never again existed as a kingdom. So why is this concept of tracing the genealogy of Jesus back to David important? Because it has to be a Davidic son. It has to be one of the descendants of David that's going to establish the kingdom again. So if Jesus isn't connected to David in a legal way, then he has no right to rule. He cannot fulfill the promises. He cannot be the one that's going to bring peace to Israel. But he is connected to David. He's the son of David, and he's the son of Abraham. To Abraham were given the promises of the land. And to Abraham were given the promises of that through Abraham, through Abraham's seed, God would bestow blessing upon the entire world. Who is it that's going to mediate the blessings of God to the world? It has to be Jesus. And that's what this genealogy is going to serve to prove to us, that it has to be Jesus. It couldn't be anybody else. That's what all the prophecies throughout the gospel are going to serve to show. It has to be Jesus. It can't be anybody else. He is the fulfiller of promises. And I got ahead of myself, because there you go. There's the slides that talk about Abraham's blessing. To Abraham belong the promises of a seed who would bring blessing to the world. To David was the promise of a son who would rule over Israel. And we talked about in 2 Samuel 7, the promises given to David in the Davidic covenant. So we come to our list that Matthew gives us. And it is a list of heroes and not so heroic. It's a list of great men and a list of mice. It's a list of faithful people and a list of not so faithful people. As we read down through this together, Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob, and Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah, the father of Perez, and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez, the father of Hezron, and Hezron, the father of Ram, and Ram, the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab, the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon, the father of Salmon, and Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David, the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. And Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah. And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers, at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, and Abiud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Eliad, and Eliad the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Matthan, and Matthan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. This section is serving to prove that last claim. Jesus was called the Christ. How can he claim the title of Christ? Christ, of course, is related to the Hebrew word Messiah. Christ is the Greek word, Christos. Messiah is the Hebrew word. Both of them mean the anointed one. Tracing it back to David, the one who was anointed to be king over Israel, God's chosen ruler. This list of heroes and not so heroic is all there to show that Jesus has the legitimate right to claim the title of Messiah, the anointed one. Now, as you go down through this list, most of them are fairly self-explanatory. Father begat son, begat another son, begat another son. But as you read through it, there are some interesting things that come up there, especially when we look at the anomalies that are presented. Most of the time, the list goes from father to son, to son, to son, to son, to son, and so forth. But four times, there's an interjection made. And the first of those is in verse 3. And it says that Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Now, this doesn't fit
My train of thought just got derailed in a major way.
Formula. That's the word I was looking for. This doesn't fit the normal formula because typically it would say, you know, Abraham begat Isaac, begat Jacob. But here it pauses and tells you by whom Judah begat Perez, the next in line. And the answer is by Tamar. Well, who was Tamar? Tamar was his daughter-in-law. And if you're familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, you understand that Judah's first two sons were wicked men. Tamar was the wife of the oldest. He died by judgment of the Lord, and she, at typical to custom, married the next brother because she had no children by the first. He also was judged and killed by the Lord before any children were born. And so Judah said, just wait, my third son will be ready for you soon. He'll come of age and I'll give you to him. She waited, and she waited, and she waited, and she waited, and Judah gave his third son to someone else to marry. Well, Tamar took things into her own hands. She dressed up like a prostitute because she knew her father-in-law's propensity to engage in such activity, and she conceived by him. He didn't know it was her at the time, but later on it comes out that she was with child by her father-in-law through a prostitute relationship. Well, that's a fun thing to include in a genealogy. Anybody find anything like that in your family history? Yeah, well, those aren't the kind of things you like to find, are they? But the scriptures don't hide them. We're going to get to what connects a lot of these things here, but it's clear to see that Matthew is not trying to hide the ugly details about Jesus' family. They are right out there for everybody to see. Now, this is typically the kind of thing that gets ignored at family reunions. Just nobody talk about Judah. We just don't talk about crazy Uncle Judah in that thing. It's a big white gorilla in the room. Nobody mentions it. But it's always there. It's always causing tension. Well, Matthew is plain to point these things out. And that's the first of the anomalies in this list. The second one is just a few verses later, down in verse 5. Salmon begot the father of Boaz by Rahab. Here's another one that's interesting because, again, if you understand your Old Testament scriptures, you know Rahab was another prostitute. We notice a theme developing with Israel's relationships. Okay. This one was a little different, however. When Joshua was about ready to invade the promised land, he sent two spies ahead of him. They went to Jericho, and for some reason, they wind up at the prostitute's house. We can only speculate why. But there they are, and she agrees to hide them because Rahab was so convinced that the promises of God were true, that God was indeed going to deliver that entire land and all of its inhabitants into the hand of Israel. They were going to be victorious. They were going to be successful. They were going to occupy this land, and she believed it. And though she's a Gentile, and though she's a prostitute, by faith, she believes the promises that God had given. And she shows that she is a daughter of Abraham, because she shares the same faith that Abraham had. Why is Tamar important? Because I think that she's showing the same kind of faith. She could have left Judah and gone and married someone else when she realized she wasn't going to be married to his eldest son. But I think she recognized, and this is just a bit of speculation, to be honest, but I think she recognized that God's promises were through Israel and his descendants. And though she went about it in the wrong way, she wanted to be connected to that. And she was. And she became one of the great, 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 many other greats, grandmothers of the Lord Jesus. So Rahab, this Canaanite harlot, Tamar, another strange relationship. Here's another one, just one generation after Rahab. And this helps us date the book of Ruth, by the way. When did the book of Ruth happen? Well, it couldn't have happened too long after the conquest because Rahab is the father of Boaz, the key character in the book of Ruth. And although he's older when he marries Ruth, it tells us that Ruth happens fairly early in the period of the Judges. Okay. Well, Ruth, who is she? Boaz marries Ruth. She's a Moabitess. Ruth's mother-in-law and her husband and their two sons moved to Moab during a famine. A very faithless act, by the way. They weren't trusting God to provide for their needs. So they went to one of the ungodly neighbors of Israel. And they abandoned God's promises to dwell in the land. And instead of acknowledging that famines and droughts were results of their disobedience, they just fled from it. And they went to Moab. Well, one of Naomi's sons married Ruth. Well, later on, her husband died, and so did their sons, and that left her and Ruth. And they returned to Israel, and Ruth went with her, a Moabitess. And again, because she recognizes the presence of God in the nation of Israel and the promises of God given to Israel, she wants to be connected to that. And so she accompanies Naomi back to Israel, abandons all of her family, all of her relationships, everything she's known, and she goes back to Israel and eventually marries Boaz. And by Boaz, she gives birth to Obed, who gives birth to Jesse, who gives birth to David the king. These three, each of these three women, I don't think are included because they're women, and that was necessarily strange. It is a little odd that he mentions the mothers of these people, but I think they're included as a way to exhibit the faith that these Israelites are God's chosen people. They prove themselves daughters of Abraham because of their faith, like Abraham's, in God's promises. When was Abraham accounted to be righteous by God? When God called him out of his tent, said, "Look up at the stars of heaven, if you're able to number them, that's how many your descendants are going to be." And Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. Those promises of a seed, of abundant descendants, were given to Abraham, and when he believed that promise, that's when he was accounted righteous. When these women believed the promise that God gave to Abraham about the blessings, that's when they were included in the people of Israel and in the Messianic line. There's a fourth woman mentioned, though she's not mentioned by name, down in verse 6. David was the father of Solomon. Now, what did some of your Bibles say here? Who has a King James for me? Gary, read that line for us. Okay, of her that had been the wife of Uriah. Who's got an NASB? Anybody have an NAS? Jess, is that Jerry? Okay, see now the NASB says Bathsheba. My ESV says by the wife of Uriah. In this case, the King James actually is the most accurate translation because it literally reads by her of Uriah. It doesn't mention a name. It doesn't tell us it's Bathsheba. It doesn't even say that it was his wife. It simply says David begat Solomon by her of Uriah. Now, why is that interesting? Because even though she's not named here, we all know who she is. We know what happened in that relationship. David committed adultery with Bathsheba, and to cover it up, he murdered her husband Uriah. And later on, they conceived again after he married her, and she gave birth to Solomon. And so included in this messianic line are people that are not something that is normally talked about. We have prostitutes, we have Gentile people, we have idolatrous people, we have adulterous people, and yet they're included in the messianic line. Some other interesting things that come up in this list that do instruct us in who Jesus is. These names, of course, included because of their faith in the promises that God had given to deliver Israel through the seed of Abraham. All of that pointing to just, you need to be like these people. Okay. You need to be like Tamar. You need to be like Ruth. You need to be like Rahab, who trusted the promises of God and were included in the messianic line because of it. They understood that in order to experience the blessings that God had promised, they needed to be connected to God's people. They needed to approach it by faith. They were looking for the coming of the Messiah. Now, as you go through these lists and you begin to compare names, and I know probably nobody else in here is nerdy enough to do this. I understand that about myself. Of course, I don't like the term nerdy. Scholarly sounds much better, doesn't it? I'll call myself that. I'll let you all think the other word, that's fine, because I know that's true. If you take this list and you compare it to the books of 2 Kings and the books of Chronicles and the books of Ezra and all of the other lists that are given to us in the Old Testament, you'll find some interesting comparisons. The Old Testament gives us this list of kings: Abiah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Joram, Ahaziah, Joash, Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham. Right there in about the middle of the Israelite kingdom, you have these list of names. Matthew, and I start here at Abijah because from Abraham down to Abijah, Matthew and the Old Testament agree 100%. They're exactly the same. But then we have this. Matthew says Abijah, Asaph, which is an alternate spelling of Asa. It's not a mistake. Abijah, Asaph, Jehoshaphat, Joram, Uzziah. So if you look down at verses 8 and 9, who is listed as the son of Joram? Joram's the father of Uzziah. But that's not true. Now, I have a point to this, so bear with me, okay? We talked a little bit about modern scholarship and ways of interpreting Matthew and the Gospels last week in our introduction. And here is where many scholars will say Matthew made a mistake. While he was copying, he skipped over a few names and accidentally went from Joram to Uzziah. Or, option number two, if you go down to the end of Matthew's list, verse 17, all the generations from Abraham to David were 14. And from David to the deportation to Babylon were 14. And from the deportation to Babylon to Christ were 14. And they'll say, well, it technically wasn't 14. Matthew skips over three names. Why did he do that? Well, he's just trying to be poetic. He skipped the names on purpose in order to make the 14 fit. He says, well, there's 14 from Abraham to David. Let's make it so that there's 14 from David to the captivity, and let's make it so that there's 14 from the captivity to Jesus. That all makes it real pretty and nice. The trouble that I have with this, and I cannot tell you how much time I spent this week poring over the Old Testament list just to try and figure this out, because that explanation didn't sit well with me. And I was a little disturbed, in fact, to find some of my favorite commentators accept the one of those positions. Either that Matthew made a mistake and it's a scribal error, or that Matthew was simply trying to be poetic and forced the number of 14 upon these lists. Why do I have a problem with that? Because that's not how God handles His Word. Is the Bible inspired in every word, or isn't it? Does God honor His Word? Has God promised to preserve it, or hasn't He? And He has. So as I pored over these names trying to get an answer for myself, here's what I came up with. And here's what I discovered in looking that there is a very good reason why Ahaziah, Joash, and Amaziah are excluded from Matthew's list. Remember what Matthew's trying to do. He is giving the legal, official genealogy of the Messiah. If you go back and look at the names that are listed there, Joram, the first one, he is mentioned. Joram is mentioned as the father of Uzziah. Joram married Athaliah, the daughter of the wicked king of the northern kingdom, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. How many of you looked up when your kids or grandkids were being born and you said, I want to name my child Jezebel? What year was that the most popular name for girls? It wasn't.
And do you know why? Nobody wants their kids to be like Jezebel. She was one of the most wicked rulers in history. And her husband, Ahab, was just about as bad. And she pushed him along, and they were two of the most corrupt and wicked rulers in the history of Israel. Joram married their daughter, who was of that line. God's judgment rested on the house of Ahab because of their wickedness. They were not going to continue ruling Israel. And Exodus 20, verse 5, warns of the punishment to the third and fourth generation for idolatry. Joram was an exceedingly wicked king. He pulled Israel into blatant, flagrant idolatry. His father, Jehoshaphat, was a righteous man, and yet Jehoshaphat allied himself with the king of Israel by marrying his son to their daughter. It's a frequent happening in nations. They marry their sons and daughters in order to form alliances. But in this case, what it produced was a huge incentive for the southern kingdom of Judah to go into the idolatry that the northern kingdom was already involved in. And because of that, and because of God's punishment, his judgment that in Exodus 25, that he will visit the iniquities of the father unto the third and fourth generation. Here's what I propose, that the next three generations after Jotham were left out of the official list as a judgment. Even though if you go back and look at the names again, Joram, Ahaziah, Joash, Amaziah, Ahaziah only ruled for 1 year and he was killed by bands of Syrians. Joash started off as a righteous king, but later on turned his heart against the Lord and was punished for it, and people rose up and assassinated him and put his son Amaziah. Amaziah started off as a somewhat righteous king, but later on hardened his heart and was also judged by God, and he was assassinated, and Uzziah was put on the throne. So why are those three names missing from Matthew's list as a judicial punishment? Because of their idolatry, because of their leading the nation astray, because of their uniting with an ungodly nation of Israel who already dwelt under the judgment of God. God had told Ahab and his house that they would not rule over the nation of Israel for more than a couple of generations, and God was seeing that that took place. And so while we understand that Christ is descended from these people, in the official lists, their names are removed as a divine judgment against them. So, did Matthew make a mistake? I don't think so. I think it was purposeful. I think those names were removed on account of their idolatry and their wickedness. Thus, the three generations after Joram were expunged from the official genealogical record of the Messiah because of Joram's wickedness. We understand his son was a wicked man, Ahaziah. His grandson, Joash, was not. And his great-grandson. But even they hardened their hearts after a time and rebelled against the Lord's command. Now, as you continue on the list, there's some other places where people say that Matthew made a mistake. And it's going down to verse 11. Josiah was the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. Here's where you get into another interesting problem. And again, I say interesting because I'm a scholar. We'll use that word, okay? These things interest me. I don't know why. You can ask my wife. She just rolls her eyes and shakes her head at me. And she'd come down in my office and I'd say, look at what I found here in my study. Okay. Josiah is listed in verse 11 as the father of... Who's your text say Josiah is the father of? Jeconiah. Here's the problem. When you go back to the Old Testament, Jeconiah is the grandson of Josiah. There's an intervening name, and that is Jehoiakim. Now, don't get these two guys confused. It's Josiah, Jehoiakim, and then his son, Jehoiachin. Josiah went to fight Pharaoh, who was going up to the Battle of Carchemish, major battle. Josiah got killed. And there's a little bit of an interesting thing going on here. When he comes back, it says, the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in his place. This is different from the standard wording, his son reigned in his place. As you're going down through Kings and Chronicles, typically when one king dies, it says, he died, he lived so many years, he was buried, and his son reigned in his place. Could it be There's a difference here. Could it be that Josiah had not chosen his firstborn to rule after him, but had instead chosen his grandson, Jehoiachin? There's a little more that goes into this. Because in 2 Kings 24:17, Zedekiah is called Jehoiachin's uncle. But in 2 Chronicles 30:16, Zedekiah is called Jehoiachin's brother. Matthew says that Josiah was the father of Jeconiah and his brothers. It wasn't Jeconiah's brothers, biologically speaking, that ruled during that time. It was his uncles. Because the line goes Josiah, Jehoiakim, and several other men, and then Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin was removed from power by the king of Babylon, taken into captivity, and then his uncles ruled. Why does Matthew say it's his brothers? Why does 2 Chronicles call it his brothers when 2 Kings calls it his uncles? Scribal error? Did the copyists make mistakes? Again, I don't think so. God doesn't treat his word that way. I think what happened is this. Josiah adopted his grandson Jehoiachin. He didn't want his own son to rule on the throne of Israel because he knew his son was a wicked man. And even though his grandson was only 7 or 8 years old at the time, before Josiah went off and got killed at the battle with Pharaoh, he adopted his grandson and appointed him to rule in his place, but the people didn't listen. And because Jehoiachin was legally adopted by his grandfather, that makes, in a legal sense, his uncles his brothers. This is sounding a little bit like Ray Stevens' song, "I'm My Own Grandpa." But I think that's what's going on here. Josiah adopted his grandson. The people didn't follow Josiah's wishes, and so instead they made his oldest son king. And so Matthew follows the legal precedent, which makes Jehoiachin the adopted son of Josiah. So again, did Matthew make a mistake? I don't think he did. I think he's very purposeful about this. There's one more interesting omission here. Matthew jumps from Shealtiel to Zerubbabel. But in the Old Testament lists, Shealtiel is the son of Padiah. Shealtiel gives birth to Padiah, and Padiah gives birth... he doesn't give birth to him. You know what I mean. Zerubbabel. Okay. As for this omission, we can only speculate on this. There are three places in the Old Testament where Zerubbabel is called the son of Shealtiel. In the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, and the prophet Haggai all list him as the son of Shealtiel. The only place that we even see his real father's name, Padiah, is in 2 Chronicles 3. Why do they omit his name in every other reference to him? We can only speculate. I don't know. I think it might be a similar answer to what we said before. Probably, Padiah died young, and Shealtiel took care of his grandson Zerubbabel. But why the 14s? Did Matthew force this issue of 14 generations, these three segments? I don't think he forced it. I think he is giving the legal representation of the line of Messiah, and the reason that 14 is significant is that it couldn't be one generation on any side of Jesus. It had to be him. If there was 14 from Abraham to David, and there were 14 legal names in the genealogical record from David to the deportation, then there would be 14 more from the deportation to the restoration of the kingdom with the Messiah. And so it couldn't have been one generation either direction. It had to be Jesus. In a similar way that when we look at Daniel's 70 weeks, and we understand that there would be 69 of those weeks come to pass when the Messiah was presented to Israel. When did that happen? It happened the very day Jesus had his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. It couldn't have been 10 years on either side of it. It had to be that day. Isn't math a great thing? Kids, you understand why you got to study math? Okay. God gave us math as a gift. We got to understand it because it makes the universe understandable to a certain extent. But all of these issues point to this one central fact. It had to be Jesus. If you want in on God's blessings, then you have to come to God through Jesus. Jesus is the son of David, who will mediate or who will rule over the kingdom. If you want to be part of God's kingdom, then you have to bow before the king. You have to swear allegiance to God's king. If you want in on the blessings that God promised Abraham, then you have to come through Abraham's seed, which is Jesus. Everything points to Jesus. He is the Messiah. He is the promised seed of Abraham. Why is Matthew so intent on pointing to the Jewish people to that? The same reason we have to be intent on pointing people to him. Because he's the only one that can save them. He's the only one through whom the blessings of God are going to be given to the world. There is no other person who will do it. If you want to approach God, if you want to be part of his blessing, then you have to come through his son. You can't come through anybody else. And so the question for you this morning, as we finish up our time of worship by singing the song, Jesus, I Am Resting, you have to ask yourself this question: have I sworn allegiance to God's appointed king? Am I part of God's plan of blessing because I've come to Jesus, the seed of Abraham? So as Dan comes and leads us again, ask yourself this question: are you really resting in Jesus? Have you really bowed before the king? Have you acknowledged that Jesus is the only king of Israel and the king of your life? Let's sing together.